Welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. My name is Austin Chadwick, and Chris Lucian here is co-host. And definitely very, very excited today to have John Cutler on the show. We got so many excellent topics. I hope we can get to them all. If not, you know, just getting to one will be awesome. You know, we got collective sense making. We got, you know, taking the spirit of mobbing and taking it to maybe non-code things. And shipping and learning are some of the topics we might hit today, but we'll see where it goes. But before we jump in, John, do you mind giving an introduction about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me too. This is, I've been looking forward to this now for months. So this is awesome. This is a great day. So my name is John Cutler. I currently work at a company called Amplitude, where I'm a product evangelist, where you can think of me as sort of like a voice of the company. I do a lot of workshops with customers, future customers, kind of doing workshops most of the day in some ways. But you know, my goal every day is to help people think about product development. I don't really sell our product, which is kind of cool. The product is just an extension of that. So it's sort of like I'm an extension of the company as a product. And I do what I really like to do. I use Twitter a lot, and it's kind of an understatement. And I blog about things and write, I think I have about 700 blog posts sitting out there floating around, and draw doodles and everything. So this was kind of a dream job. It's like an extension of my normal flow. That's kind of what I do. And I have a background in product management and UX research. Companies here in Santa Barbara, AppFolio, where I used to work, and Zendesk, other crazy ad tech places, and Viacom and MTV. And then the funny part is I had a video game. My first product was a bartending CD-ROM game called Last Call, which you can find on YouTube. And it was built in like Director or something. And it's a game where you never call a game Last Call, because it's like not, you can't really make a sequel unless it was called After Hours. That was the idea, to call it After Hours. but it was banned because it had like lewd content in it. So Kmart decided not to cover it. So anyway, that's a whole other story of the video game getting banned, but that's a little bit about me.
Right on. Well, I guess so many good things. Let's jump right into collective sense making, both by shipping and other ways. So what are your thoughts here, John?
Yeah, I think where we were going with that was, you know, I sort of been involved in the Agile community. So product manager, you know, involved in shipping code, right? But as I started to think about it more, I started to really think about this kind of sense and respond loop. Or we have this saying at Amplitude: are you shipping faster than you learn, or learning faster than you ship? And so what I've increasingly seen, and it's kind of fascinating, because I think it really depends on who you're talking to. I think that a lot of companies are actually learning faster than they can ship. Like fundamentally, they have a problem. They're wading through maybe a lot of debt, or this is very difficult for them to deliver anything at any rate. But I guess maybe just due to the luck of the different companies I've worked at and the companies I interact with, the other end of the spectrum are companies that are shipping way faster than they can learn. So their ability to deliver stuff is far outpacing their ability to sense whether any of this stuff is working in the market. And so that's kind of where I was going with that thinking, where I think it's putting a pressure on teams to really think about what the constraint is. Is the constraint how fast you're delivering software? And I remember sort of saying to Gene Kim, or talking to him about this, and I was like, well, how much of the investment is going to knowing whether any of this stuff is working the way that you think? Like if you were to spend time developing new features versus figuring out how to know how people are using the product right now, or as we used to do at AppFolio, we used to get in a van and go and visit customers and just step away from the keyboard for a week. That was a better use of our time to do it. So that's kind of where I'd be curious on your all's thoughts with it, because it's something, you know, that I think about a lot, where it's important to talk about. It's also important to talk about that it's not everyone's constraint. You know, you really could be in a situation where just building the muscle to deliver anything could be a major advance. And then maybe just building the muscle to deliver something that's even marginally useful could be an advance. And then building something that's marginally impactful for a customer could be an advance. And it keeps on kind of going as a muscle we need to build more and more and more. So that's kind of my thoughts on that. I don't know what you all think. about that?
Yeah, I actually really like the idea because, you know, you can definitely have a really tight development cycle without, you know, tons of customer feedback, or not even customer feedback, but maybe like heat maps and stuff, just automated data collection about what the customer is doing. And I think I have a couple of stories. You know, once I was working with the military, and you know, the feedback loops were slow, so we were kind of like in that space of not shipping fast and not learning fast. and then you know, an emergency kind of started happening, and they kind of said we need software right away, and we just need this working and in production as fast as possible. And so then it went to we're delivering fast and we're learning fast. So there's kind of, it was kind of like a light switch, you know, where they went from one to the other. But I've been in other situations where delivering fast and learning slowly existed. And in those cases, a lot of the times, you know, as a developer, I just say, hey, let's just throw Google Analytics on this page real fast. It's a one line copy and paste, and we'll just see if anybody goes to this part of the site. And all of a sudden there are like massive changes happening in the application based on a tiny little bit of data. I've definitely had experiences, you know, over my career of being in each of those scenarios, I think. And then the learning fast and delivering slowly, I don't know if that's as common as delivering slowly and learning slowly.
Yeah, that's a great way. I mean, really, that would happen, right, where, you know, there's just almost like a massive inventory of learning. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem there, too, is that inventory of learning is growing stale, too. So it's depreciating sitting there. But that would happen, for example, you know, it happens a lot in industries where it's like, our field sales team, we have people in touch with customers every single day. We have all this stuff. We just know we need to ship, but we can't execute it. We just need to ship this particular thing. I'm just acknowledging that sometimes that happens, right? Like if things do grind to a halt, you can accumulate this inventory of learning. I think one other interesting part is you could think on a macro cycle for a company, that at first, you know, you haven't really done anything yet. And then you learn a little bit, which is the kind of kernel of the idea. And you kind of go in and out, you know, it's natural to kind of, it's not like you ride the perfect line between shipping and learning. It's more like you're dipping into the kind of learning area. Then you come back, you're in this sort of period of like a lot of execution and a lot of delivery. And then as the business matures, often there's like a little less to learn. So as you've had a product that's been out in the market for a while, you know, you've got the backlogs, like you're very rarely surprised by feedback from customers. So I think that's another thing that's important mentioning is that there's almost like macro cycles of this. I think the trouble though, is a company that is so confident that it's learned everything. And then really it's getting disrupted, you know, like it really has not flipped the switch into the new, it hasn't hit the inflection point where it needs to dip back into the learning well again to do that. So yeah, it's a kind of interesting way to think about it. I think about it a lot.
Yeah. And I'd be curious, this is an area of learning and growth for me that I've really been striving to get better at lately. And I kind of have a story and I'd kind of like your advice on it a little bit. So I joined a team. And it kind of felt like the scenario.
It's a cigar. Sorry, okay, keep going.
Oh, okay. I guess the salt. All right, done.
Sorry, we could.
No worries. So when I joined the team, they maybe were in the space where you're talking about. At least internally, it felt like learning was high, but the ability to ship was low. So a lot of things weren't automated. It was hard to get things out. It was a slow process. So we worked really hard to reach that kind of like CDZ, the continuous delivery zenith, right? And so we automated a ton. We really sped up the feedback loops internally. So like, even if we weren't shipping to the customer on day one, we're getting internal feedback every day or very quickly. And then we were at the point where we could release daily or multiple times daily to the customers. And so we kind of overcome some of those hurdles. And then I kind of reached a point of kind of like, okay, so we have all this CD, we have all this, what's next? What am I, you know, are we missing something else? You know what I mean? And that's when you started talking about like, I believe on this team, there was a lot of feedback coming from people in the field, like, you know, who work with the customers kind of bottling up. And then that's kind of like fed our backlog. But I didn't feel like, maybe it's just like, I didn't feel trendy. Like we weren't using these cool analytics or these new UX, you know, things to really make sure that we're learning what the customer really wants and what's to do. You know, like, is there a next step when it's
kind of interesting. And we always say this, I'm the first person to say this. I mean, I work at a company that focuses on quantitative, like analytics like that, but you know, the qualitative stuff is super, super, super important. And in fact, sometimes the quantitative stuff is just helps us guide us in the direction of qualitative things. And then the qualitative stuff might get us curious about what to measure on that side. So there's, you know, this idea that everyone needs to be like Netflix, you know, A/B testing every like micro little change. I think a lot of people get obsessed by that because they're obsessed by the idea of certainty. They're obsessed by the idea that the systems will tell them you are great. You have made the right decision in most products. And look, even at Netflix, when it comes to long, mid to long-term strategy, you can't A/B test that. You know, you're not like A/B Gibson Biddle has a great talk where he goes through 10 years of Netflix iteration to work on one capability. Failure, 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 slight little movement, failure, 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 slight little movement, strategy, movement, strategy, movement. And so one thing to think about, I think, is that people think the quantitative side, people look to the quantitative side for especially maybe more like analytically minded people want that level of certainty that it works 100%. So yeah, to make that clear in the beginning, I think sometimes the, you know, sometimes people think the next level is just fancier forms of experimentation. And certainly in some businesses, those are the really interesting things happening. Like imagine running, you know, 200 concurrent A/B multivariate experiments behind feature flags, and you've got to determine what's impacting what and has anything broken. There's a lot of stuff in observability around that. Like, are we these super complex systems? That's certainly like next level in its own regard. But for a lot of companies too, it's how do we get more strategic? You know, how do we place a portfolio of bets? Like, we're very safe at the moment. We're just kind of exploring the same area and we keep kind of coming back to the same thing. How, if you think of a product as a series of promises that we keep, and that basically we reinvent how we keep those promises. The promises tend not to go away. They were the same 20 years ago as they were right now. And what you find is then I would ask a team, well, what are your riskiest bets to reinvent how you keep that promise? And that, I think, is for a lot of teams when they feel like they've just maxed out. Yes, there are some fancier techniques to eke and optimize every little tiny bit of the thing of the product. And sometimes those create step changes and new novel findings. And certainly companies like Airbnb and other people have great examples of doing amazing work with that. It's not necessarily the next level for every team about where they're at. So sometimes it is actually the ability to place kind of longer brewing bets or trying to find these unique angles of a customer job that's you've been really good at doing, but could you reinvent how they do that? And so I think that that's the next level for a lot of teams is creating, how do you place a portfolio of bets? Some that are like a lot riskier where you can learn faster, and then some that are a lot safer that are probably less likely to kind of change the business. So I think that I have a talk called Think Big, Work Small. And the basic idea is that, okay, so what do we used to do? We used to plan big, work big. Okay, well, we realized that didn't work, right? So then people started to basically, you know, okay, so let's like work smaller. Okay, so they plan big, but then they figured out how to work smaller. Okay, so we're going to do the project in a bunch of different chunks. Awesome. Okay. And then it seems like we got down to this area where people like, they're like, think small, work small. Okay, great. Yeah, we're kind of working. It's great. And what they lost when they did that is it was sort of like we exchanged waterfalls for whirlpools. You know, it's like we're just kind of going around in circles and don't know what's going on. And so I think that that's the next level for a lot of teams is, okay, they've stopped planning big, working big. They, you know, they started to think about more outcome oriented, like, user-focused outcomes. They've got that nailed down. But now they need to like pivot back, not into planning big, but thinking big. Like, where do we need to take the company? What are the riskier bets we need to make at the moment? I don't know if that helps, Austin, but that's like what your question inspired.
Yeah, no, I really like that a lot, because I think big and maybe, what was it, act small or something like that?
Yes. Yeah, like think big, work small. Yeah.
Work small.
Because work small is a muscle.
Yeah.
Legitimately working small is better. Okay. Yeah. But if you're working small and thinking small,
yeah,
like it doesn't, and a lot of the agile folks too, it sort of annoys me, because I feel like I was like, well, what's the last product company you worked at? Like, I get it, but the idea of, well, you know, just kind of wander down the hall and I show them this, yeah, that's kind of useful. Can you build that for me? Yeah, sure, I could build it because I architected it so extensively. And, you know, I'm not going to optimize anything. And I can work so fast that you just change your mind and I'll be there for you. You know, it's amazing. And like, I get the emotion, like I get the whole idea there, but it's not how a lot of it just doesn't register with a lot of the really successful teams that I work with that are balancing that keen ability to work tiny and small, but also thinking in quarters, you know, thinking about a bet that they're playing out. So I don't know if that, well, yeah, I don't know. There's a little bit of like myth and reality with this.
Yeah. Well, so I think I do see a lot of this, like, you know, maybe there is a long-term plan, a roadmap for a product. Right. And a team might be delivering small, but then on the product, but that roadmap never seems to change, even though new information makes it in, right?
Right.
And so I'll see thinking big, working small, and blindly following a plan.
Yeah, right? That's kind of planning big, yeah, right? Like that's the annual roadmap and it doesn't do it. And so, for example, yeah, the workshops that I get tied up in doing, which I love, is something called the North Star Framework.
Yeah.
And in the North Star Framework, you actually come up with a framework that represents the value exchange in your product, like the promises, the capabilities your product does, but it's completely agnostic to solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so that stays stable relatively. That's the thinking big, like, okay, that's our hypothesis.
Yeah.
But the minute your hypothesis changes, you change the North Star. And also the options and experiments you want to run will definitely change and inform each other. You know, like Amplitude, one, you know, our North Star is weekly learning users, not weekly querying users. Because if you sit around querying an analytics product all day, you're not doing your work. You're just sitting and querying an analytics product, right? So a weekly learning user has these elements of like sharing their learning with their team, collaborating, because our product's focused on collaboration. So our inputs are basically activated accounts. You got to data into the system. It's got to be clean. It's got to be working and running, and you've got to get your team onboarded, broadcasting the learnings, which is like I share with Chris a learning, and then consumption of learning is the long tail learning of the learnings that I shared. So if it becomes the dashboard for our team, that becomes something that like, that's another input. But the interesting thing is that hasn't changed in the 3 years I've been at Amplitude. How we've focused on solving those and moving those levers has definitely changed to do it. So that's that kind of like think big as you got this big idea. We're not planning big, but we've got a hypothesis out there that's bold and interesting. And then we're obviously trying to work small. You know, we're trying to experiment. Well,
so to me, like, it kind of gives you this a feeling of maybe, you know, to me it's thorough exploration of the 80-20 rule.
Yeah.
So like, you know, at all levels of the product. So, you know, I, cause you know, I don't want to be feature complete in this one area. I want the 20% that the 80% of the users are going to use and in that area. And then I want to then satisfy this other area and this other area and this other area. And as the product gains adoption, then start exploring that 20 to 80% or the 20 to 100% of remaining features in that area. But I see lots of people do micro iterations down that same path and then become feature complete everywhere. And they sacrifice all the benefits that they get from lean or agile, that sort of thing.
Yeah. It's, Austin, I didn't know if you, you had something to say. I didn't want to jump
Please
in.
Go. Please go. Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking there too, that this idea, back to this idea of promises that the product keeps and thinking about that, like a very common thing is, you know, what are those teams doing? Well, they're just shine. They're just like, they're just spit polishing the product. They're just like finishing it. What's that team? They're innovating. Yeah. Oh, they're innovating over there. And it's the same promise. And they basically siloed the team. Like, that's why I'm not too comfortable. Like, there's these ideas of like pioneers, settlers, town planners, or, you know, are you the loon shop person? Or are you the, it kind of makes people out that we're all very unidimensional. And I think this comes to the sense making thing and kind of moving beyond stereotypes that people have where, you know, yeah, I might want to do that pioneering thing for 12 months, but then I want to slip into this other mode, you know? Like, so I think that that's one element here too, that your comment reminded me of is, what does it mean to innovate? And then where do, how do we silo those people? And then what would it mean for a product team to always maintain like a nice portfolio of bets? Like, oh, we can water the plants with watering cans right now, or we can deliver the water by drone. The drone thing may not work. So you know what? We're probably not going to be successful at doing that. But if we wait like 10 years or assign it to drone team X, or just try to outsource it to some other company, like we're not going to build the muscle to do that.
And maybe one, I think you've kind of answered it, but I'll ask a clarification question to make sure I got it. So like, you know, think big, work small might be like big thing, but then you run a small experiment to find out if it works from the market or whatever. So big doesn't necessarily mean like time or size is kind of what I'm hearing. It could be right. Big as far as what's a differentiator in the market or what's, you know, big cost of delay return or, you know, any of that kind of stuff.
Totally. That is a great point because I think, you know, MBA students, everyone is persuaded to think of like bold vision, big vision, you know, chatbot strategy or something like that. Like, yeah. Like it's very, you know, yeah, bigger is better. The plan, you know what, your first 90 days, then dream up how you're going to spend money in the next 12 to 18 months. And then you'll spend that and you'll get forgiveness for another year. And at that point, you've been at the company 2 to 3 years, and then you can just leave gracefully and then probably get paid more to join another company. And no one will know why it didn't work too. So there's this whole push to basically push for big batches and big ideas to carve out the budget, carve out the space you need. Totally not that type of thinking. What I mean by that is thinking like, so when I mentioned the Amplitude example is really thinking holistically, like casting a big net to our perception of the market, the strategy we need. And in fact, a good strategy, I mean, I really like in Good Strategy, Bad Strategy, he makes the point that we should learn strategy from the underdogs, not from the people with endless resources, right? Because you don't have endless resources. So the idea when you're a small company of like, we just need to execute. They're looking at the massive company that has so much fire. Like, I hate military stuff, but they've got like a lot of pawns to throw at the problem, you know? And if you look at those companies, you are not going to be able to be like that company. You're not going to juggle 18 balls in the air. You're like not going to be able to do it. So in fact, it's sort of counterintuitive, but by thinking big and sort of mapping out what you think of the space, it might actually end up with a very narrow area of focus where you think the fulcrum point is, the leverage point is in the business. So it's counterintuitive. Like you, maybe I should come up with a better, it's not think big batch or big plan. It's sort of thinking holistically about the problem as it stands right there. And so a lot of the workshops I do is I'm like, you know, they'll say something like, okay, the initiative is shift to the cloud. Like, why? That's a solution. What do you mean it's a solution? It's like what we've got to do for our transformation. I was like, well, no, it isn't. Like maybe shift to the cloud's the wrong idea. Like why is the cloud the better thing? What are you trying to achieve with the shift to cloud? Oh, it's gonna be faster. Why do you need faster? Like let's get down to the real mental model here. Like what is the crux bet here? Is it you're gonna go out of business if you can't ship, or is it that like you need to innovate? And so at the end of that exercise that happened this morning, it was, we're in an industry that throws a lot of new complex data types and data models and things we need to understand. And it's extremely difficult to have new business without a way to be able to scale the kind of complex domains that we need to cover in an on-prem solution. Okay, now I've got something to work with. So the strategy is you're scaling out to new asset types with new types of customers, and you need to be able to think about how to absorb complexity into your system without it manifesting in every piece of on-prem software you need to run to do it. So that's like, that's what I mean by thinking big, is just like keep, it's not like why necessarily as much as it's assume that that's a solution. What is the problem again? Assume that's the solution. What is the problem again? Assume that's a solution. What is the problem again? So that's, maybe that's an example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Your comment earlier about allowing people to move between roles or in the town, I think was a good segue for the specific examples of applying the mobbing idea or spirit to non-technical teams. So just wanted to kind of explore that a little bit and see what you.
Yeah, I mean, first I would kind of shine. I mean, we had like Woody at a company that I was at, like I follow the work and, you know, so I've participated in this. I think had Tim Ottinger barking at me in a room or something. I've done some of this, right? But like, yeah, what is the current thinking on the cross-functional nature of the mob? Like that would be, I would ask that question. Just, I'm interested. Now you can help me out.
Oh yeah. You know, I think there's an extreme version of this, Val Labs in Japan. They manage train data. They're really interesting, but they mob everything. They mob HR, they mob finance, they mob, they mob everything, like the whole company. Also when I was visiting their offices, like they had a safe release train, but it was every role across the business. And so it was this giant wall with what everyone was doing and like how and why. And it was really, really interesting. So like that was like the most extreme example I've seen. You know, for us, like cross-functional, Austin, I don't know if you want to talk about it a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so we strive for as much diversity as we can. But you can only, you know, stretch so far as it comes to roles and backgrounds and perspectives. And, but, you know, so we just are always seeking that as much as we can. So, I mean, we love hiring people from multiple different backgrounds, whether it's QA, whether it's, I love pulling non-technical people into the mob as much as possible to be like, hey, we're struggling with this design. Can you come in and give us rapid feedback as we change it? And then sometimes they give the feedback and, you know, go away, or sometimes they hang out and they love it. You know, I've heard of some mobs where the product type person is maybe not on the call all day with the mob, but one screen is looking at what the mob is doing the whole day. And so if they see something interesting, they'll pop into the call and be like, hey, I have feedback on that or whatever. And
yeah,
so
yeah. We had a product owner, or we have a product owner that would actually lead, you know, it's a remote team and we're using like TeamViewer or AnyDesk, but they basically had the TeamViewer up all day and just spontaneously jumping into the mob whenever they saw something that they were working on and they had feedback on.
Yeah.
So those are the sorts of like product owner relationships that we've really looked forward to. We've also had other we've invited people to mob that were like in the finance department that you know, just like completely unrelated, like not part of the work, but just like, hey, come and experience this for a little bit. Like, and that's been good too.
If you sit them in front of Excel, they'll probably like spec out all the business logic you need right there.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly. You're doing Excel, you'll
be good. They're like, oh, they're like writing object oriented, you know, like Excel. Belgium, you're like, yeah. Oh, okay, you solved the problem for us.
Yeah. It's funny. And then one other thing I'll just add is the more typical mobbing for us is where it's like, you know, a full day of mobbing is more technical cross functionality. So like in my current mob, we have a solid DBA person, and we have me who's kind of more from a QA, you know, kind of, you know, coachy, you know, interpersonal, lean, agile background. Maybe TDD background. They have some people who've just been traditional developer. We also have someone who loves automation, so they're always looking to script anything manual. And so it's cross functional, but maybe more on the tech side.
That's super helpful. I mean, one of my big things that is this idea of like, you know, start together, work together, finish together. And so starting together is something that I'm really passionate about. I mean, I'm passionate about all three of those. The finishing together is the outcome part, right? Like, that starts it, work together. People generally understand. They're like, oh, kind of work together. They don't really understand, but they think they get it. The start together is a lot more contentious. It's like, wait a second. No, that's going to be totally messy. You know, like start together, everyone in the room, you know, so I'll say, well, yeah, the whole team should start together. We should, when I was here in Santa Barbara, I worked at a company here and we would, they've kind of shifted it over the years, depending on how they do, but we might spend a week or two, you know, stepping away from keyboards, doing research together, UX research would, we were mobbing together. We were going on site with customers. Now they stepped away from doing that kind of religiously all the time, depending on the effort. But when it's really important, they would do that, which is really funny because in Silicon Valley, at least, it's actually not necessarily, or in a lot of the companies, it's not necessarily a very, it's a highly individualistic approach with very, very, very clear boundaries of control. So you are a design leader, you are a tech leader, you meet with the product manager, you will tee up the effort perfectly, you will work on it for 3 months beforehand, you will write the stories, you will give the product requirements document. These companies just happen to ship pretty quickly. Like otherwise though, in the balance, they're still pretty staged in how they're doing it. So I find that pretty fascinating that like, and they will reject the idea of starting together. Oh my goodness, that's so inefficient. Oh, I mean, everyone will get so bored listening to customer calls all day, or, you know, no one wants to talk strategy. And I'm like, you know, that person's like an expert Settlers of Catan player. Like they understand strategy. Like don't, like you're sort of diminishing the people in the room. Yeah, to do the things. So you get the idea that it's like, it is very interesting to me that something, it's even something like starting together can be pretty contentious, but that's sort of in my world when I'm thinking about a really cross-functional kind of mob or group of people and sense-making. You know, there's not code writing happening at that particular moment, but it's certainly like, you know, we'll using event storming, for example, is like really effective activity to get different people involved. Interesting thing about event storming is, you know, I really do, it takes everyone to step a little outside of their comfort zone. So, you know, developers want to make it very, very quickly about a data model, you know, and then you've got a UX researcher who's coming from a background of customer journey mapping. And then you have a product manager sort of like, well, why are we doing, you know, when are we going to get to work? What are we going to do? And you're inviting people from the business in there who are very domain focused, have no idea what the developers and designers are doing with all the sticky notes on the wall. They're just sitting there answering questions. So I think that event storming is a really great example of how everyone needs to step outside of their comfort zone a little bit to create. But once you get it going, like once the group gets up there and they're, once they are making sense of things, like once their mind is being expanded with every new sticky note up on the wall, it is really like magic to see everyone kind of contributing. And in a sense, they are kind of mapping logic, you know, they are kind of thinking about a lot of things at once. But that's one thing that's, I'll just end with that, is that I'm a big advocate. There's different traditions. There's a lot of stuff within design around, you know, design, like the UX side of it, which is about making sense of things and mapping a space and mapping a domain and understanding like the nouns and verbs that the people use. There's tons of stuff in the design community. And then if you go into the domain-driven design community or the BDD community, there's a whole other world of that. And I was surprised that those worlds don't talk a lot. Like, no wonder the developers think that designers are just making mock-ups and the designers just think the developers are just executing our code. They haven't seen these traditions across the aisle for doing that. So a UX person is doing an event storming exercise and like, okay, this is kind of like customer journey mapping, but we're also fleshing out the information architecture. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, okay. And then the developers, there's like, we're kind of doing functional, like functional, I'm not an expert in this, but like we're kind of doing functional programming. And I'm thinking about the data model.
Yeah.
And then they're both using their words, but they're talking about a very similar thing. And the product manager is like, well, we're figuring out what the problem is here. You know, so they're each using their own language, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah. I think in our flow, because we work on IoT projects and we have mechanical designers, firmware engineers, electrical engineers, and software engineers all working together. And so what you described, it wasn't like this 10 years ago, but I think today, you know, we really do, we say, hey, we're going to build this piece of hardware. And it's mechanical, electrical, firmware, and software, often is started roughly around the same time. Everybody's kind of starting together. They're not, you know, obviously mobbing, you know, but, you know, maybe some of the other engineering roles are kind of treating it in a more traditional way, but we have started more of this like cross team or cross departmental lean coffees happening. And just talking about how do we work better together often, and trying to come up with action items about, you know, how to work well together in this cycle. And it's been really good. So it's kind of evolved to that once the software was operating in a certain way. So that's been a really good side effect.
I mean, you need the foundation of those things. We have Jack McCloy is on our team at Amplitude, is working on our design systems like thing. And he, that's just a great example of, you need certain technology and things to fall into place. I mean, I remember being a PM on the team and just seeing these designer and developer just struggling to work together, because it was more like, I'm doing this in Figma. And then it's like, oh, you know, and then literally after thinking about this, it's, you know, the designer's like, oh, this is really cool. Can I just start checking in this stuff? Like, you've just, you know, why don't, like, I'm working on it, you're working on it. You know, the developers kind of thinking about other logic and like what call, like mocking the calls, and the designer is sitting there and writing the front end and doing that particular thing. And I think that that's just like magic. I think that that's where, you know, even, you know, in tools like Figma and the design community now, there's increasing appreciation that this will eventually not be a case of handing over, that you are, you know, that whatever the no code examples, but Figma is a good example. It's like a designer playground, but there's increasing awareness that you are actually like thinking about logic and kind of proto coding these things. And so I think that that's super exciting, but also explains for some teams where they're like, we tried it, it sucked. Well, of course you tried it, it sucked, because you sat around for like 5 hours waiting for something to happen. Like, that's not really magical or fun to do that.
Definitely. And what I hear from the examples you all are talking about, whether it's firmware or whether it's design or whatever the cross functionality is the kind of returning to that theme you brought up, John, of collective sense making, the magic and the almost in many cases instant buy-in people have once they see the magic happening, they experience it. Because there is, I've been hearing some horror stories lately on social media of people being put in their place, like, oh, you're a developer, you can't speak up about the design, or you shouldn't be speaking about the product, or, you know what I mean? Or, you know, and it coming from both sides and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, these event storming or mobbing or whatever collective sense making thing you can do, cross-lean, team lean coffees, once people start seeing the value of the multiple perspectives, the light bulbs I've seen go off before. And maybe this is a covert way, maybe it's a little controversial, but I've been doing it more lately, is that whenever it's almost like ad hoc mobbing, where as soon as I start to see those maybe biases forming, or like people waiting, or, oh, those guys over there, I'm just like, well, let's just add them to the call and let's figure it out right now, you know? And then like,
that's an amazing point. I mean, it also speaks to the idea of, I mean, I write all these funny things about high work in progress or other things like that. And so this is, there's two funny quotes that come from that. One is talking to a team, they're like, we know it's working when we spend longer on it. So to me, that's the epitome of product thinking. And that doesn't mean that they are spending a long time shipping things. It means that when they're on a roll, there's good learning coming back in and they keep going. Like, that's amazing. You know, you're not like a factory line. You're not there to, and that really kind of challenged my thinking about Kanban and other things. But the other perspective of that too is just creating an environment where anyone can breathe and show up at a meeting and spend like the kind of serendipitous moments of collaboration to do that. And that's another aspect of that starting together. It's like, is it okay to spend a whole day? Anyone who's done a startup knows that you often will spend a whole day doing something and then realize you were just totally didn't do anything. Like, you were talking the whole time, but you weren't making any sense. And then you go home at night and you write an email at 10 PM to the co-founder and be like, I got it. We weren't even talking about the right thing. Like, we got to go in to talk about this. And then you start the next day and you build off of that. But then at the end of the day, you start not understanding each other. It's really hard to make sense of things when you're working as a group. And so if you don't have the bandwidth to think, if you're kind of pressured into these sprints, if everything is sort of mapped out for you, I think that that's another, like, we need time and space, because the thing I've noticed a lot is that a lot of product managers very much want to involve developers in aspects of strategy and thinking about this stuff. And then they wonder, well, why is the developer not interested? They must not care about the product. They just care about coding or whatever. You go and talk to the developer and like, actually, our whole incentive structure as an engineering team is shipping stuff. And I have a day job. And you're asking me to do this. And I really, really want to help you. But I don't have time. Like, I don't have time to help you. And so there's this kind of, you need that. This kind of goes into incentive structures in the company and what people are, you know, what the structures, the sprints we create, points and all crap. Like, it all boils down to like, are you creating these moments where you can kind of take those little diversions? Yeah, all in all to say is it's hard. And if we don't leave time for it, or space or energy for it, it's also really it's energistically taxing. If you go into these conversations where you think you keep spinning around, if you're not on, you think that this is the biggest waste of time. But if you're on, you're kind of like, okay, we didn't really get anywhere, but I learned so much more than I did an hour ago. And so I think a lot of developers who try to do this pairing with UX or product, no one's in the right mindset. They try it and they're like, I don't care about the strategy. Please, can you just figure out the strategy? Like, just tell me what to build, please. Like, don't put me in another one of those rooms where you like get the Google Slides out again, like get me out of there. So this has a lot to do with like the energy you have and the environment you create to do it.
Yeah, and I'll give maybe one testimonial of the system fighting against this collective sense making. I've been there, I've seen it.
Yeah.
I switched to where mobbing was kind of the way to go. And what I immediately recognized was it wasn't like the whole team, you know, product, UI, UX, firmware was incentivized to work together and we all owned it. And so it didn't feel like anybody was stepping on anybody's toes. It was all encouraged to everyone's part of this. You know what I mean?
And that is a huge, and that's what I was saying about a lot of people.
Yeah.
When you're deep in the Silicon Valley world, a lot of people don't realize how individualistic, how it's sort of promotion driven development. It's employee retention driven development, and the two are related, which is sort of like, well, we got to keep that person. They want to use Kafka. So, all right, y'all, we're like, we're going to use Kafka. Like, we're going to do a pub sub system for that. And someone's like, we don't really need to do that. Oh, but they wanted to try this technology. And so like 12 to 18 months later, people are like, well, what did Joe ship? Well, Joe is like collecting the stock options and is now on to the next company at that point. So that's like weird. Talk about incentives and talk about the companies also we use as role models. I think it's important to have diverse set of role models for how companies work. That's why I like how you all, you know, not specifically talking about your employer, just promoting how people tell stories about other ways of working gives a nice counterbalance to like the myths and heroes that we create out of the Bay Area, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we're running up on time. So John, is there anything that you wanted to plug or share before we close?
No, I mean, this has just been great. This, like, I've been looking forward to months. Like I said, this is amazing. We could chat forever about it. Nothing to plug. I mean, reach out on Twitter. Like, I always try to answer all these particular questions. Probably do my wrap up of the Beautiful Mess blog posts again for this year. So we're in about 100 blog posts deep of this new project, or 90 or 80, once a week.
Nice.
And I did a book for the first year, the wrap up, and I'll probably do that again. I'm getting itchy though. I did a 41A and 41B last night. So obviously like I'm trying to get them all into the year. maybe do that, but just reach out. It's fun. Yeah. And I think tell the stories. And one thing I think one offer would be is if you can't tell the story yourself, and you want someone to kind of like talk to you. I did this for a CTO friend recently, and there's a Twitter thread that just like blew up where he said, I do not want to talk about this. I cannot talk about it, but the world needs to know about it. It was a story about how he basically like pulled the brakes completely on everything. And then the next day they just started like had, you know, 100+ people just work on one thing and like got regained the trust in the engine going. So if you ever want that kind of thing, I mean, just you get in touch with me and then I'll tell the story and put my like, you know, social capital behind it so people believe it. Yeah. So I could be stories as a service as well if you're eager to tell that kind of story. So
all right. Well, cool. We'll put your Twitter handle in the show notes as well as your blog and make sure cool. that happens. For all our viewers out there, if you are thinking about product or product delivery or mobbing and thinking about things related to products, this is probably a great episode to share with them. So please share. And then for you yourself, please like and subscribe and hit the notification bell so you know when new episodes come out. And until next time, we'll see you later. Bye, everybody.
See you. Bye.